Earlier this month, a Quinnipiac poll found that 44% of white Americans believe Donald Trump is a racist. That's compared to 79% of black respondents and 58% of Hispanics. Meanwhile, the Southern Poverty Law Center reported that in 2017, the number of hate groups rose to 954 from 917 the prior year, up 4%. New research is helping to explain why people join hate groups and how members who want to leave can be de-radicalized. Wes and Zena wrote about these efforts in a recent piece for Mother Jones, headlined, "Inside the Radical, Uncomfortable Movement to Reform White Supremacists." In the article, he profiles Shane Johnson, a former Klan member, who joins us to explain why he joined and why he left. Wes and Shane, welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Absolutely. Wes, we're approaching now the anniversary of the August 12th rally by the alt-right last year, which ended in disaster at Charlottesville, Virginia. In your view, in your research, did the election of Donald Trump encourage white supremacists to be more open about their views? Is that why membership in white supremacist and nationalist groups has grown since Trump was elected?
I'm not sure I would answer that question directly, mm-hmm. although, you know, my article profiles Shane Johnson, who's on the line, I believe, and yes. also an organization called Life After Hate, which works to de-radicalize white supremacists. It's actually the only group in America that does that. Mm. And what I would say about Trump is that Life After Hate was around, it began in 2011, and it's composed of former white supremacists who work to de-radicalize other white supremacists, sort of a support group, essentially, to do that kind of work. They were around until in January 2017, the Obama administration gave Life After Hate a $400,000 grant as part of the Department of Homeland Security's countering violent extremism efforts.
Just as Obama was leaving office.
Just as Obama was leaving office, they had awarded them a grant, so $400,000. And then in June, so which is 7 weeks before Charlottesville, the Trump administration revoked that grant.
And why was that?
There has been some reporting. They said... One official told the New York Times that it was because one of the members of Life After Hate, Christian Picciolini, was tweeting anti-Trump stuff. There are other connections that a New York Times article alleged that the Sebastian Gorka and his wife played some role in it, but we don't know exactly why, honestly. But what we do know is that this really was the catalyst for Life After Hate to become huge. So for 2012, when they were formed, 2011, 2012, until 2017, they hadn't done a lot of work, and then they got this $400,000. But then when Trump revokes the money, they blossom. They become huge because they do a good job of sort of promoting a narrative, which is a totally fair and accurate narrative, that this is insane, that we're seeing this enormous spike in the boldness of white supremacists, and now they take away our money. So Life After Hate went from receiving something like one email a week from people who were seeking help or from family members seeking mm-hmm. help for their white supremacist affiliated son or brother or something to 10. So it jumped tenfold. And since Trump has revoked $400,000 from Life After Hate, they've made up for that double in donations. So the $800,000. So they went from 30, their sort of revenues. I was looking at their filings. Went from $37,000 in 2017 to $800,000, including $50,000 from the football player Colin Kaepernick.
Wow! So your story looked at this movement, this effort to reform white supremacists. That like a group like Life After Hate, that's their mission. Now, Shane, are you there? I'd love to ask you a question now, if I could. Wes's article begins with a violent incident that took place on July 4th, 2013, when you were still a Klan member. Can you describe that incident? Tell me what happened and how it changed you.
I can try, man. I was heavily intoxicated, and I really don't remember too much of it, to be honest with you.
Give me the summary of what you've been able to piece together since.
So, we was up for like 3-4 days, something like that. I was pretty high on Adderall and uppers, and I was drinking on top of it. And there was some words that were swapped between one of my members as he was coming over. Some guys that were African American said something to him that he didn't like. Of course, he didn't say anything back, but he comes into the house that we're at and tells us what happened. And uh, it ended up, we tied padlocks to bandanas and put them in our back pockets. And I guess the plan was to go down there and confront these guys, but there was a concert going on at the time. And it really just turned into, we just kind of randomly started attacking people. I mean, it wasn't even just black people. It was white people. It was everybody.
Wow.
Everybody that was, everybody that we laid eyes on, we kind of just started swinging on them.
And this attack, and, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and then the cops came and beat the hell out of me. But
yeah, and then you were...
But yeah, one of the more embarrassing moments of my life.
I mean, this attack did not come out of nowhere. You grew up in Kokomo, Indiana, and, to a well-known Klan family. Your dad apparently appeared in full robe and hood on the Jerry Springer Show in the 90s. He spent hours a day teaching you about Christian identity. What was it like to be taught from a very young age that being a Christian man meant marching toward racial Armageddon and fighting blacks and Jews in order to escape eternal damnation? What was that childhood like?
Well, for me, it was normal. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have a reference to any other kind of lifestyle. So, I mean, it was just life. That's how it was. I mean, cross lightings were common. Even like my family, what I considered my family was Klan members, you know, but it was very, there was always a sense of like paranoia. Everybody was paranoid all the time. It was paranoid that, you know, the feds were listening, or, you know, or this guy was trying to join because he was an undercover agent. I mean, it was a whole lot of paranoia. And other than that, it was tons and tons and tons of Bible study.
Mm. And yeah,
hours a day.
Bible study through a white supremacist lens, not the Bible that many of us otherwise learn.
Right. Yeah, correct. Yeah, Christian identity, man, to sum it up for people who don't know, it kind of just, they use the Bible and twist the Bible to say that the Jews are the literal descendants of Satan, and basically non-whites have no soul, you know? So, and they can never go to heaven. God doesn't recognize them. So it kind of made it easier for me, like with the, going back to the July 4th thing where we went to the concert and was attacking people. That's something I look back on now. Like I said, it's embarrassing, but it's also like, you know, people hear that and they think, how could you do something like that? You know, but when you believe that the people you're hitting don't have a soul, and you believe that you are ultimately doing something that's, you know, to better your race. Mm-hmm. It sounds so goofy, man. But I mean, at the time, it was something that I was proud to be doing. You know.
And then what happened? What was the revelation that made you realize you wanted to leave the Klan and leave this sort of lifestyle?
It was a combination of a lot of things. It didn't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. Certainly didn't happen overnight. You know, but there was some things that my now wife had said to me. One of the things that stuck out was she asked me if she was not involved in the Klan, by the way. She was not involved in any kind of white power movement,
mm-hmm.
Which is strange. But I often dated women that were not involved in the white power movement because the ones that were honestly just weren't that attractive. So I dated outside of the movement, and sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. In this case, it worked, but she always respected my beliefs. She never brought it up. It was kind of like, that's business. And you know, we don't talk about it. Hmm. But, one of the things she asked me one time was, we was driving down the road and she said, let me get this straight. If there was a black child here, a baby, and you could kill the baby and get away with it, would you do it? And, you know, instantly my response was, of course, you know, obviously I would do it. You know, I'd essentially be stopping hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other African Americans being born. But even though I said it, and I said it with conviction, like I was, you know, obviously I would do that. In my head, for some reason, I had this thought that was like, man, I probably would not do that, you know? Huh. And that's one of the moments that really sticks out, because that's when I started really, really thinking about, well, if I'm not willing to do that, well, then I'm kind of lying to myself, you know. And it led to who the hell are you, you know, and do you believe these things or do you not believe these things? And, you know, I was smart enough, I was old enough and smart enough to know, like, I haven't even really investigated the other side. You know, I'm hating people that I don't even know, and I don't really even know what they believe in.
Yeah.
You know, like in like progressives and left leaning people. I never even had dialogue with one, so I don't, you know, I didn't know even what they really believed. And I was going off of what I was told pretty much.
I'm Matt Katz. I'm speaking with Mother Jones senior editor Wes Enzina about his most recent story on white supremacists, along with Shane Johnson, the subject of his piece. Wes, you write that what Johnson was experiencing was a reckoning when he was starting to second guess some of the white supremacist ideology that he grew up with. And that's common for many white supremacists, a sort of ideological hangover after waking up from years of hate. So even as the number of hate groups has increased since Donald Trump rode into office on some racial animus, so have the number of people trying to leave this movement. Why is that, do you think?
Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to do in the article was look at Shane's story, and I spent a lot of time with Shane and talking to him, but also to put it in dialogue with the stories of other people who were getting out of the white supremacist movement or who had gotten out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a whole sort of new movement of academics and activists who are focused on this work. And they're sort of trying to perfect the science, if you want to call it that, of how all this works. So, for instance, Shane's experience it dovetails with the experience of many others. And one thing that nearly always happens when people are getting out of a white supremacist movement is a dissonance between the ideology and the actual life they're living. Shane mm-hmm. just described some moments where he experienced that dissonance. Another common moment is what a sociologist named Peter Simi refers to as the contact hypothesis, which is a term in sociology, which is essentially that, as it applies to former white supremacists, it's that nearly everyone who gets out of a movement has a moment where they have the seeds of doubt in their mind have been planted, and then they meet a single individual who sort of overturns every stereotype they have, or at least begins the process of that.
Sure.
So among the founders of this organization, Life After Hate, that I mentioned, which Shane would end up interacting with and getting some support with, though it was pretty far along in his process. You know, one of them told me that he described empathy as playing a key role in getting empathy at a time when he least deserved it from those he least deserved it from, played a foundational role in his transformation. And so for another guy, Frank Meek, who was a neo-Nazi in Philadelphia, for him it was getting a job from a Jewish business owner. For a woman named Angela King, it was falling in love with a Jamaican woman. So, you know, those are some common experiences, is this dissonance and then meeting an individual who overturns their stereotypes. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is also added to this is some science about the neurochemistry of how hate works. And it's really just a beginning, this looking at hate through the lens of addiction. But there are some academics who have been doing this. And so another thing that the academics found and the activists found is the presence or recurrence of something called residuals, which is a term they basically took from addiction studies, from addiction, which is unwanted, involuntary feelings of hateful ideology coming back to them when they think they're long beyond it. So
like a craving that an addict would have.
Exactly. And that's where they got the idea from. And so there was one 2017 study where a researcher interviewed 89 former white supremacists, and he found that in dozens of them, they described these residuals. So for one man, it was his daughter, 15 years after getting out of hate movements, his daughter dating a Mexican American man, and he just freaked out. And then afterward was like, what just happened? Yeah. Where did that come from? I thought I was so beyond that.
Yeah.
And Shane has some pretty interesting experiences, both of the person who was his sort of his facilitator, whoever turned to steroids.
That was AC. After the violent incident in the park, Shane, you were sentenced to 8 months of house arrest, and you were starting to explore the world on an old laptop. And then you came across a Facebook page of a group of socialists and anonymous activists in Indiana, and then you met this guy AC. Who was he? How did he help? Who was he, and how did he help you begin the process of leaving the Klan and that ideology?
He's an interesting guy, man. he was kind of bored, I guess. I was trolling their page, to be honest. I mean, there was a part of me that was interested in hearing what they have to say, but then there was this other part that I still felt like I was right, ultimately. So, right. When I say I was trolling, I was trolling. I was on house arrest. I didn't have nothing else to do, you know. And he started sending me private messages and these conversations between me and him. It was more like a debate back and forth on things, just whatever was happening, you know, current events and stuff like that. And I found myself agreeing with him, you know. To be honest, I'd find myself during the debate, I'd find myself agreeing with him on things, and I would still argue with him, you know. And this guy, he never gave up. He's kept on and kept on. And it ended up turning, you know, you talk to somebody, man, woman, anybody, without meeting them, it doesn't matter. If you talk to them on the internet or on the phone, whatever, for a long period of time, you kind of get to where you can, you feel like you know the person, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's eventually what happened. I couldn't see that he was Hispanic at first. And by the time I found out, I didn't even really care, to be honest with you. You know, I was having more deep conversations with him than I was with any Klan member I ever had, you know.
And that really started you on a process to turn away from that world.
Well, yeah, to accept other ideologies. That's where it started. And other things, I started watching different shows on YouTube and stuff, like the Young Turks and Bill Maher and even like George Carlin videos. You know, this is stuff I never seen before, you know. Mm-hmm. And at first I would get mad watching him, and there would be times I'd have, especially George Carlin, there would be times I'd have to get up and, you know, walk off, cool down a little bit, because I'd get that angry about some of the things they said. But again, I would find myself agreeing with some of it, you know. Yeah. So it was a bad spot to be in my head, you know, at the time, because it was like I was fighting with myself. But eventually, you know, it eased up. But I want to touch on something you guys were just talking about when you're comparing it to addiction and having a reoccurring thought. That still happens to me.
You still get residuals?
Not so much. I do, but not so much right now. Not anymore, not so much racist thoughts. I did when I first dropped out. It was uncontrollable. And the only way I could correct, I recognized that it was happening. You know, like, let's say I seen a black guy and a white woman walk down the road, I'd have this thought, you know, it's racist thought about it. And then I got to where I would recognize that I was having the thought, hey, man, stop that, you know. You don't even know these people.
Yeah.
And I just kind of, like, correct myself, and it eventually went away. But there's still times I'll be at a gas station buying something and it would be $14.88, you know, $14.88. And it just instantly, I feel like, I don't know how to explain it, man. It's like a, it's an odd feeling. It's like, it's always going to be with me.
You have a son now. I'm curious what you tell him about race or African Americans, if you've begun to speak to him about that.
No, he's only 10 months old. Oh, okay. I talked to him, but
well, never too young.
He don't really listen.
But what would you tell him? I mean, when he's 3 or 4 or 5 years old, once you're able to have these conversations, how do you think you'll explain to him, you know, why we're different colors, why we're different religions, diversity? What are you going to talk to him? How are you going to talk to him about that?
Well, I hope that by that time, man, I kind of have the Morgan Freeman look on things right now. Mm-hmm. I feel like if the less we talk about it, the less we recognize race, racism will kind of go away. You know, Morgan Freeman said that, and I kind of feel like he might be right. If my son ever asked me, you know, about races and things, things like different races and stuff. And then I'll just explain to them the truth, you know. One day I will have the talk with him about my past, and because I mean, it's not like I can avoid it. And that's his whole, my side of the family. So, you know, they were all clan. Any family photos that I had at one point, it was all clan photos.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's not something that I'm going to be able to hide from him.
Sure.
But I don't think I should hide it from him either. I'll just tell him the truth that there's people out there that are ignorant and racist. And then, you know, and when it comes to races and religion, everybody has the right to believe in whatever they want to believe in, even if they are, you know. Even that's for racists too. Racists have a right to be racist, you know.
Wes, I just wanted to get to Wes real quick in the minute we have left. Is there some hope in Shane's story in terms of how others can leave the white supremacist movement and join the rest of us in an open and welcoming society?
Yeah, I think there's a tremendous amount of hope, especially because Shane's story is so extreme in some senses, and he, in so many ways, has entirely turned around. You know, there was a moment when I was visiting him in Indiana, and he mentioned offhand, I overheard it, to a woman at a convenience store counter. She said, "What do you do?" And he said, "I'm a civil rights activist." And I think that he's pioneering, along with these other former white supremacists, an identity in the Trump era of the former, of this is how you can overcome racism. You don't have to hide it. If you were a racist, you can move on.
Thank you so much, Wes, and thank you, Shane, for sharing your story with us. I really appreciate it. I'm Matt Katz, and I've been speaking with Mother Jones senior editor Wes Nzina about his recent story, Inside the Radical, Uncomfortable Movement to Reform White Supremacists. Read that piece, and thank you to Shane Johnson, the subject of his piece.